Good morning. The killing of Alex Preti by federal agents has many Democrats ready to withhold funding from DHS, and that could mean a partial government shutdown. We ask Democratic Senator Chris Murphy for his take. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A winter storm has blanketed large parts of the country with snow, ice, and freezing temperatures. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. With hundreds of thousands still without power, how are local officials trying to help those affected? Also, what do we know about an investigation into two of China's top generals? And as part of our series, America in Pursuit, we look at the French engineer who came up with the plan for Washington, D.C. It's Monday, January 26th. Happy birthday to R&B legend Anita Baker. She's 68 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal judge will hear arguments in Minnesota today about whether to rein in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. This comes 2 days after federal agents shot and killed a protester in Minneapolis. NPR's Jennifer Lund reports it's the second fatal such shooting this month.
Minnesota has asked the court to declare the federal surge unconstitutional and unlawful, or at least prohibit officers from certain harmful actions. And it says the matter is even more urgent after this weekend's fatal shooting of intensive care nurse Alex Preti. Homeland Security has sent some 3,000 immigration agents to Minneapolis. It says the aim is to stop benefits fraud and arrest criminals. The state, led by Democrats, argues the real aim is political, and it says officers' aggressive tactics are harming innocent people, draining local budgets, and leaving many afraid to leave their home. Today's hearing is about a temporary pause while the case plays out. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Minneapolis.
The National Weather Service says that mammoth winter storm isn't over yet. Winter storm warnings are still up from Kentucky to Maine. More than a dozen people have been killed by the weather, and 750,000 customers are out of power. The worst affected state is Tennessee, where 250,000 customers are in the dark. From member station WPLN, Justin Barney reports.
The National Weather Service is describing travel around Nashville as dangerous to impossible. But with so many people without power, some, like Alejandro Marin, are looking to brave the roads in search of shelter.
No power at the moment. No heating as well. So our house is slowly dropping in temperature. I might be going to a hotel, potentially, just to find some warmth.
The impact of the storm pushed area governments to open all fire department stations and some police precincts and community centers as 24-hour warming centers. For NPR News, I'm Justin Barney in Nashville.
A new survey of business economists finds cautious optimism about sales in the coming months. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the survey suggests businesses are more likely to add workers in the near future than to lay people off.
The survey by the National Association for Business Economics shows the most positive hiring outlook in several years. About one in four firms say they plan to add workers in the next 3 months. Less than one in 10 is planning to cut jobs. Underlying that hiring forecast is the expectation of stronger sales ahead. More than half the firms surveyed expect demand to grow in the coming months. Only about 6% are projecting a drop in demand. About three-quarters of the economists surveyed expect higher tariffs to remain in place. Most businesses facing higher costs say they're passing at least some of that increase on to consumers in the form of higher prices. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, Dow futures are flat. You're listening to NPR. The Federal Aviation Administration says a private jet crashed in Maine yesterday morning. It was taking off from Bangor International Airport in steady snow. 8 people were aboard. No details were released about their conditions. There are differing views over the outcome of this weekend's 3-way talks among Ukraine, the U.S., and Russia. The talks were held in the United Arab Emirates. The Associated Press reports that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says a security agreement with the U.S. is 100% ready to be signed. But the Russian news agency TASS said today only that trilateral talks on Ukraine would continue next week. The teams are set for the Super Bowl. The Seattle Seahawks are returning. They beat the Los Angeles Rams yesterday 31-27. The Seahawks will play the New England Patriots, as NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
2 years ago, Seattle fired their longtime coach and hired a new guy in young defensive hotshot Mike McDonald. Then last year, they brought in a new quarterback. The Vikings and Jets cast off Sam Darnold. Now they've cashed in. The Seahawks went 14-3 and now have a chance at their second ever Super Bowl title. The Patriots will be playing for their seventh. New England faced the Denver Broncos, who were starting their backup quarterback after their starter broke his ankle last week. After halftime, heavy snow began and the Pats escaped with a 10-7 win. New England fans had to suffer 6 long years without a Super Bowl appearance. Now with the young quarterback Drake May under center, their wait is over. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Again on Wall Street, Dow futures are lower. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Historians point to the end of World War I as the start of the modern era, a world of cynics, bobbed hair, and shorter hemlines. The era also saw an upswing in the popularity of ballrooms. One of the roomiest was St. Paul's Coliseum Ballroom at the intersection of University and Lexington. The owners claimed to have the largest dance floor in the world, 25,000 square feet, and would give anyone $100 if they could prove them wrong. Opening in the early 1920s, the Coliseum Ballroom had its own house orchestra, but it also lured in the greatest jazz stars of the day, Duke Ellington, Fats Waller, and Louis Armstrong. Fads come and go, and as the dance marathons of the 1920s and 30s gave way to the sock hops of the 40s and 50s, which took place in school gyms and cafeterias, ballrooms found it harder to attract a crowd. Many closed their doors, including the Coliseum in 1958.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
On a Monday, this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. The second deadly shooting of a U.S. citizen by federal immigration officers in Minneapolis is raising the prospect of a partial government shutdown.
Most Senate Democrats say they will not vote to fund the Department of Homeland Security without additional guardrails for immigration enforcement. But that opposition may also stop a $1.3 trillion spending package needed to keep large portions of the federal government open past Friday night. In a few minutes, we'll ask Democratic Senator Chris Murphy what he plans to do. But first, let's get the background.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass joins us now. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Layla.
So how did this second killing in Minneapolis change the state of play in Congress?
So Democrats had already been raising alarms about the conduct of immigration officers. Last week in the House, all but 7 Democrats voted against the Homeland Security funding bill, which includes money for immigration and customs enforcement and customs and border protection. Some Senate Democrats pledged at the time to do the same thing, but not as many, because the Senate has been set to vote on the funding measures as one mega package. So a vote against Homeland Security funding would also be a vote against spending bills for defense, health, and more that have overwhelming bipartisan support. Then after this second shooting, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announced that Senate Democrats will not provide the votes if the DHS funding is included. And in the Senate, these bills cannot pass without some Democratic support.
Okay, so if Senate Democrats withhold support, will that stop the crackdown we're seeing?
So Republicans in Congress already gave ICE an extra $75 billion last summer. So Democrats withholding their votes this week is not going to stop the crackdown. But they say they don't want to hand over the $10 billion or so more dollars that's on the line now. Here's Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar on NBC's Meet the Press.
When they're killing 2 constituents in my state and they're taking 2-year-olds out of the arms of their mom, no, I am not voting for this funding.
This DHS funding bill also includes money for disaster relief and the Coast Guard, but Democrats are betting the public opinion is on their side here. And Senate Democrats who voted last fall to end the government shutdown, they say they too are now willing to vote no on this funding despite the risk of a shutdown.
So Senate Democrats do have some leverage. What do they want?
Democrats already secured more funding for officer body cameras and oversight, but they had wanted a lot more, like banning the agency from deploying excessive force. Schumer wants to peel off DHS funding so lawmakers can keep negotiating and approve funding for everything else to avoid a more sweeping shutdown. But spinning off the DHS funding will take buy-in from Republican leadership.
Is there buy-in from Republican leadership? What are they saying?
Well, the Appropriations Chair, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, told the New York Times she is exploring all options. But this is really getting down to the wire, in part because of the snowstorm and because the House would have to sign off again, and they are in recess. Speaker Mike Johnson appears unlikely to call members back. Now, more broadly, a few Republican senators are calling for an independent investigation and hearings. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana said the credibility of ICE and DHS are at stake. And with the midterms ahead, I will be watching whether we see more daylight on this between Republican lawmakers and President Trump.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Layla.
Now we hear from Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut for his take on the DHS funding question. He is a Democrat, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
I understand that most of the caucus is planning to vote against this DHS funding bill. Just what went into your decision?
Well, DHS is an out-of-control agency. It is not complying with the law. And it's not just Minneapolis. I was in Texas last week trying to get access to some of these detention centers where people are dying, and DHS wouldn't let me in. That's in direct contravention of the law. I went into one of these immigration courtrooms and saw them violating the law every day, disappearing immigrants who are here legally. This is an agency that's jeopardizing the safety of the people of Minneapolis, is violating the law left and right. And we're just not doing our job. We're not upholding our oath if we're funding an agency that's out of control. So that's what went into my decision. I only want to fund a federal government that's involved in complying with the law and is not running an agency that is ending up routinely with Americans and residents of this country being killed. And I think that's what people want. People want us to fund DHS, but they want us to fund only a department that is making our community safer, not making them less safe.
Is the administration making any effort to change your mind and the minds of other Democrats? Are they offering, for example, any specific reforms that they could make to their immigration enforcement campaign that would make you and other Democrats comfortable with voting to fund DHS?
No, in fact, they're doing the opposite. When things started to get very dangerous in Minneapolis after the first shooting, they surged more untrained ICE and CBP officers into the city. After the shooting yesterday, they went on television and lied through their teeth to the American people about what happened, calling this young man, an ICU nurse who works with veterans, an assassin. So they are inflaming the situation. They are doubling down on their illegality. It's why the American people are turning against them in this operation and why they're demanding that Congress demand reforms, which is what we're going to do this week.
Just a point of clarification, the shooting was Saturday. The latest shooting was Saturday. So two arguments that we're hearing on the Democratic side against this. One is substantive and one is political. Let's just take them separately. The first is that blocking this funding would be a mistake because it'll delay funds for things like disaster relief and the Coast Guard, and that ICE is going to be able to operate anyway due to the funding it got from last year's Republican tax and spending bill. What do you say to that?
Well, there's nothing that would stop us from constraining the use of dollars that are both in the annual budget, but also the big, beautiful bill. And the fact of the matter is, we aren't going to ask for the entirety of the Department of Homeland Security to be reformed. We're going to ask for targeted reforms that will make our communities safer. We're going to ask, the things that we certainly could demand and talk about are ending these roving patrols of officers who are not trained to do that kind of door-to-door operation, requiring warrants for arrests, requiring identification and body cameras. These are things that would make these operations safer, would result in fewer people being hurt. I think these are going to be common sense reforms that we'll likely talk about, things that the Republicans really have no reason to be against, because I think the American people will support them.
Well, the second argument against this political, I mean, this is an argument being advanced by, say, a Democratic think tank, that the administration is going to spin this as defunding law enforcement, and that that tends not to go over well.
Well, listen, I think the American people are pretty clear about this. You see, 60-70% of Americans in polls saying that ICE is out of control right now. They see an administration that is acting lawlessly. So, as I mentioned, we're not going to be talking about doing away with internal law enforcement. We're going to be talking about reforming the way that ICE is operating, so they're paying attention to the law again. They're not making these communities any safer. And of course, we're starting to also learn that there may be a much more insidious motive here. Over the weekend, Pam Bondi sent a memo to the state of Minnesota and said, "We'll leave Minnesota if you turn over your voting rolls to us." That sounds like they're using ICE as leverage to try to take control of elections. Donald Trump has made it pretty clear that he wants to rig the next election, and ICE seems to be potentially a pretext for that. So every day this grows more serious, and every day I think the public is making it 100% clear that they want us to only fund ICE, to only fund DHS, if this agency is acting lawfully. And that's the bottom line of what we are going to be talking about this week.
We have to leave it there for now. That's Senator Chris Murphy. He's a Democrat from Connecticut. Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
China is announcing that two of its top generals are under investigation. One of them is the nation's most senior general. Analysts suspect it's a political purge, capping a two-year campaign by Chinese leader Xi Jinping to clean out the ranks. NPR's John Ruich reports.
The announcement came from a defense ministry spokesperson on Saturday. Here's a clip from state TV. Generals Zhang Youxia and Liu Zhenli of the People's Liberation Army, or PLA, are being investigated, he says, for suspected serious violations of discipline and the law. It's a big deal because Zhang was the ranking vice chairman of China's central command, known as the Central Military Commission. Only Xi Jinping stood above him. Liu was also on the commission.
This is really an unprecedented kind of decapitation of the leadership of the PLA.
Taylor Fravel is an expert in Chinese security at MIT. He says it's hard to know exactly what led to the investigations. The government has said almost nothing. But Fravel says an editorial in the Army's official newspaper left a clue. It accused the two men of having, quote, trampled and undermined the Central Military Commission chairman responsibility system. This is arcane stuff, but he says it means something important because the chairman is Xi Jinping.
That is clearly suggesting that the main problem is that they have been defying Xi, which means that they have posed a political threat.
In other words, they were purged. Bonnie Lin is an expert on Chinese foreign and defense policy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She sees it as part of the multi-year cleanout of a military that's long been plagued by factionalism and corruption.
I think this is Xi Jinping being very set on making sure that China has the military capabilities to both defend itself from what I think those in Beijing increasingly view as a more problematic external environment.
In other words, geopolitical pressure from the U.S. and its allies. Xi also wants a military that can do what he wants, including potentially taking the island of Taiwan by force. But Lin says there's a cost.
In the short to medium term, he's definitely degrading what they have in terms of leadership expertise.
Zhang Youxia, now under investigation, was one of the very few leaders in the Chinese military with warfighting experience. Most now have none. John Ruich, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
where we pull up a chair to one of our members' kitchen tables. We get to know them a little bit better.
Good morning.
So why do you listen to KEXE, KBXE?
Because it is the best radio station I have ever found. I don't remember when I started listening to it, probably 20 years ago. And you have science, phenology, which I love. You are kind people. You respect everyone. You are always on the side of those who need help. I just wish I could clone you and take you all over the world. I've been wanting to say this for years, and I tell everybody I know to tune in. You know, you're the kind of people that make the world a good place. Friends, coming back in style.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From the University of Maryland Libraries, home to the NPR Archives, dedicated to preserving the history of public broadcasting and serving researchers around the world. More at lib.umd.edu. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. 250 years ago, the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence. It marked the beginning of the United States of America. Over the next 5 months, NPR is bringing you stories about how that project took shape. The pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness from 1776 to today for a series we're calling
America.
America.
America. America in Pursuit.
We begin here in Washington, D.C. The year is 1791. At the time, the city, if you could call it that, was really just a vast swath of undeveloped marshland. To turn it into the capital we see today, with wide avenues, public squares, and a national mall stretching toward the Potomac, the Founding Fathers needed a visionary. They found one in Pierre L'Enfant. He was a French engineer who believed so much in America that he changed his first name to Peter. With pencil and paper, he mapped the city that became Washington. But full recognition of his contribution did not come for more than a century. Rebecca Rossman has his story.
To see the first blueprints for Washington, you have to go underground. They keep it in a basement vault at the Library of Congress.
Okay. Come on in.
Reference specialist Julie Stoner holds the keys to a treasure trove of some 6 million maps lying in these cabinets. She pulls out one with pencil shadings drawn by L'Enfant himself.
This was 1791.
This is the Washington before Washington existed.
So you've got the grid.
In these early versions of his plan, you can see the grid cut through by wide diagonal avenues laid over what was at the time not very much.
And you have to imagine farm fields, woods, you know, not quite as level as it is now. And he just
That's Scott Berg,
around.
Author of a book about L'Enfant called Grand Avenues. Berg says L'Enfant wanted a capital that would make this young republic feel real, powerful. After all, America was brand new at this point.
The rest of the world is looking and going, no way is this going to work. You know, it's a good idea, but no way is this going
to
work.
This scrappy young country needed to take some big risks to prove that it could work. They took one on L'Enfant, who had arrived to the colonies with a group of French engineers.
He was essentially the lowest person on the ladder that came over with the French.
He ends up at Valley Forge with a bunch of men who would go on to hold big roles in the United States. James Monroe, Alexander Hamilton.
All of these people were young. They were there. They were having a great time. And they drank a lot and they partied a lot. What gave them part of their high spirits and the headiness that they felt was that they were all sort of part of the circle of George Washington. Because
L'Enfant was the kind of guy, Burke says, who would sketch napkin portraits of his buddies. He was memorable, talented, fun to be around. After the war, Washington remembers him and recruits L'Enfant for a much bigger project. Which is what brings us here to the National Mall, or staring at the U.S. Capitol building. Berg says L'Enfant's inspiration for these grounds came from an unlikely place.
You have to think, if you stand up there on the West Plaza and you look this way, you are reminded of Versailles.
Versailles, the home of the French monarchy, with its grand grounds leading you straight to the king's palace. L'Enfant steals the idea and turns it on its head. The palace isn't for a king. It's built for the American people.
And so what you're doing is essentially saying, bye-bye, king. Hello, elected representatives of the people. Hello, hello, democracy.
It was about convincing the world that this new American experiment could work.
And they're saying, we are a new country. Everything's very tenuous. We need a show of our ambitions, of our right, of our ability to exist on the world stage.
And L'Enfant did all that at an impressive speed, drafting his first blueprints in just 2 weeks. He was confident about his work, saw it clearly, and had the perfect combination of brilliance, gusto, and naivete to push it through. It's what made him so compelling, and also incredibly difficult to work with.
He was so charismatic and driven and so precocious, but he was also like a hothead and an idiot, and you know, he reminds me a lot of Americans. He felt very American in that way. I mean, I realized
almost as soon as he started his drawings, the fights piled up. He fought with the commissioners, with landowners, with Thomas Jefferson. Eventually, his strongest supporter, George Washington, had had enough. Less than a year after he started the project, L'Enfant was fired. An engineer named Andrew Ellicott took over. L'Enfant died broke and largely forgotten. But his design stayed in the bones of Washington. And a century later, the city finally embraced him. At Arlington National Cemetery, L'Enfant's grave sits on a hill overlooking the Capitol he envisioned. That's where I meet military historian Allison Finkelstein.
We have the best view of Washington, D.C. But it's not just beautiful, it's really symbolic.
When L'Enfant died, Finkelstein says, he was buried in an unmarked grave on a friend's estate in Maryland. In 1909, Congress brings him here to Arlington to see the city that outlived him.
And it seems fitting that he should be buried somewhere where he can be honored and look out in death, at least, at the legacy of his design as it was actually instituted.
But you don't have to stand at his grave to see his legacy. You can sit right in the middle of it. Back at the National Mall, Berg says L'Enfant imagined this as a public place for the people. Although, over the years, heightened security has changed things. Sections are periodically closed to the public. Today, the Capitol steps are blocked off, and there are ropes around the grassy areas of the mall. Berg says that's a shame.
I'd like to go back up there. I used to go up there. And it's, you know, like the city, the story is ongoing. Who knows what's going to happen to the federal city in the next 100 years? And we shouldn't hold it sacred because no one place is ever, you know, places have to evolve.
Washington is still evolving. Like the American project, it was built to represent. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Washington, D.C.
This is NPR News.
Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro has a message for people who feel like pulling the covers over their heads and shutting out news and politics.
Now is a time to engage, not to retreat. And the power we have is the power to vote.
I'm Scott Detrow. Shapiro on his faith and his future in the Democratic Party on All Things Considered from NPR News.
With Area Voices, we're trying to discover what makes an artist, what drives them, what inspires them, and most importantly, why it's important to keep creating.
Theater, in particular, is an art form that sort of asks for people to test the borders and find out what people are excited about and what people are interested in, but also to challenge audience members.
I think every artist wants to show a feeling of some sort. I think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, art, I don't know anything about it. It's not my thing, and I can't critique something because I don't know anything about it. I think that's wrong. I think you're either touched by a work of art or you're not. You like it or you don't like it. And I think when somebody paints with passion, that's what they're trying to convey, is a mood, a feeling.
Tune in Wednesdays on The Morning Show to hear more Area Voices.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXC with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 5:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up in a few moments, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. Partly sunny and cold today. Highs around 5, winds from the south up to 20 miles per hour. Lows tonight in the single digits below zero. And tomorrow, partly sunny with highs again in the low single digits. Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Permits will be available beginning at 9 a.m. this Wednesday for the upcoming season. You can book your reservations online at recreation.gov-bwcaw or call 877-444-6777. Visitors are encouraged to review the trip planning guide and do your homework for the more than 265 backcountry campsites. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st, and funds will be earmarked for the library's 2027 budget. And Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District's annual tree sale is going on now. Young tree and shrub seedlings come in bundles of 25, plus native wildflower and grass mixes are also available. Order early for the best selection. Find more info at beltramiswcd.org. You can let us know what's happening in your community as far as events go. Email us, psa@kaxc.org. And January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota connects youth who have been exploited to safe housing, resources, and non-judgmental support. Help is available 24 hours a day by calling 866-824-3770.
On today's date, January 26th in the year 2004, I watch as a pair of ravens excavates a hole 3 feet into the snow in order to recover food from a road-killed deer that was buried under that snow in the ditch. One raven stood atop the pile of snow and watched very carefully while the other descended in the hole and ate. And they were clever enough, smart enough, to remember where that deer was, and when times got tough, they went back there, dug their way down to that body, and found a meal. And that just is the beginning of how smart ravens can be. These guys are true survivors of the North, and a pair of ravens together like that, they are almost indomitable. They can do these kinds of things and other equally impressive acts of memory in order to keep themselves alive through our cold winter.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. More than a dozen states, from the Deep South all the way to New England, are cleaning up after a major winter storm that brought snow, ice, and freezing temperatures.
Several deaths are blamed on the storm. Hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses are still without power, and airlines are scrambling to get their planes back in the air after canceling thousands of flights.
NPR's Joel Rose joins us now with the latest. Hey, Joel.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Where did we see the biggest impacts from this storm?
Well, the most urgent issue is that there are still a lot of people without power across the South, where this storm brought a huge amount of ice. In some places, the storm was all snow. In others, it turned into sleet and freezing rain. In much of the South, it left a coating of ice on roads and trees that made roads dangerous, if not totally impassable. It also brought down trees and branches and power lines that left hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses without power across Tennessee, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Our colleagues at Nashville Public Radio talked to Alejandro Marone, who lives in East Nashville. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
Trees have been going down everywhere across the neighborhood. And sitting in front of my place, there's been three trees, branches that have come off. So pretty intense.
Marone did not have power yesterday. One of more than 300,000 people just in the state of Tennessee, according to the website poweroutage.com. More than 200,000 of those customers were in the Nashville area.
And how are states dealing with this?
It may take days to get the power back on in parts of the South. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves says this is the biggest ice storm his state has seen in more than 30 years. At one point last night, Reeves said 180,000 customers in Mississippi had lost power. That's more than 10% of all utility customers in the state. Reeves said utility crews are working to get that power back on, but conditions are making that tough.
The real challenges that exist in an ice storm is, in many areas, it's not safe for our people to be out and about trying to do things because of the amount of ice that is on the road.
Reeves also said the problems will not go away just because the precipitation has stopped. Temperatures are forecast to stay below freezing, which means the roads will still be icy. And he urged people to stay off those roads so that emergency crews can do their work. In the meantime, Mississippi and other states in the storm's path have set up dozens of warming centers, but that may not be a big help to people in the most rural areas. You know, and also we should note the storm had impacts far beyond the South. It dumped more than a foot of snow across a big swath of the country, from Missouri all the way up to Massachusetts.
Now, this storm also had a huge impact on air travel. What's the latest there?
Yeah, this storm brought much of the nation's aviation industry to a halt. Airlines canceled more than 10,000 flights over the weekend. Sunday was the biggest single day for cancellations since the early days of the COVID pandemic in 2020, according to the aviation analytics company Cirium. The vast majority of flights were canceled at some airports in the Northeast, around Washington, D.C., New York, and Boston. American Airlines canceled more than half of its scheduled flights yesterday. Delta and United, more than 40%. Airlines are likely to cancel hundreds or even thousands of flights again today as they try to get their crews and planes back in position so that they can try to return to regular service later in the week.
I have a flight later today. Let's see what happens. That's NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you so much, Joel.
Yeah, good luck.
One of the affected areas that Joel just mentioned is Nashville. So let's get the view from there with Freddie O'Connell, the mayor of Nashville. Mayor, good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Layla. Thanks for having me.
So it's been a rough weekend with the ice and snow. You've declared a state of emergency. How is your city doing this morning?
It's a challenge, you know, taking us from last week when we saw forecasts range from half an inch of snow to up to 32 inches. I mean, we just saw some wild data in some of the forecasts. And So we knew there was going to be a major winter weather event. So pre-treating by Friday, Saturday morning, you know, 48 hours ago, light snow falling. 24 hours ago, you heard trees just snapping, cracking, even booming across the city because there was this half of inch of glaze of ice on just about everything. So it has been very, very challenging. We were talking with our local utility, Nashville Electric Service, yesterday. They think this may be the largest number of power outages they've ever encountered as a utility, ranging up to about 230,000 yesterday. So, I mean, just to give you a sense of the scale of the impact that, you know, yes, worst ice storm in more than 30 years, we overnight restored about 50,000 people to power, but that leaves us with another 175,000 or so people to get back online.
Is that your biggest concern right now? I mean, what is the challenge with getting that power back up for people?
Yeah, the power would be less of a concern, except that also overnight we saw temperatures start to fall precipitously. We were expecting temperatures today to hover in the low single digits. And so that is what's a huge concern, is just the people of safety, even in their homes. I mean, you know, with the road conditions being what they are from the combination of snow and ice over this winter event, we do want people generally not to be on roadways, but that's we also have opened dozens of warming locations, and it's a challenge because even getting to those warming locations, if you are in a home that is starting to get very cold inside with no heat, it's just a very, very challenging situation. Yeah. So we're looking at every transportation option and all of the things to keep people safe.
Do you have the resources you need to try to clean up the streets, to get the electrical grid back up and running?
Well, on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, there's just ice on everything, right? So we have more snow plows, more modern snow plows than we've ever had for treating roadway conditions. We are going to surge our utility capacity to have more than 300 line crews out there working today. And we're very fortunate to have other areas sending us support in that regard. But, you know, I mean, I guess that's the hard part, is with 175,000 people offline, it's hard to have the resources to just turn them all on in the next hour because of all the utility poles that are down, because of all the trees that are, in fact, blocking access to many things. But we, you know, we can clear trees. We have plows. We have line crews. So everybody has been working around the clock to try to resolve all these issues.
Have all your residents survived this storm?
I have not yet heard any reports of confirmed fatalities, but this is also such a challenging environment. I mean, it's an interesting scenario where last week, Thursday night, we had our point in time count, which means we were out trying to identify people who lacked housing security, people who were living outside or in shelters. And so now here we are trying to make sure that we can even identify people's conditions in their homes. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
Freddie O'Connell is the mayor of Nashville. Thank you so much for joining the program this morning.
Thanks.
This is NPR News.
My name is Mark Bjornrud, and I am now from right here in Bemidji, Minnesota, originally from the Iron Range over in Embarrass, Minnesota. Sitting and listening to Green Cheese, I felt like I was at home. All of the characters and the people that I grew up with on the radio right now and calling in, like, I don't know any of these people, but I do know all of these people.
Hello, you're on Green Cheese.
Hi, I wanted to answer the question about the haiku and syllable pattern.
Yes.
Can I give a shout-out to the Akio Islanders if they're listening tonight?
Sure thing. Let's find out if they are listening tonight.
Hi, I'm calling about the AC/DC albums.
Yeah.
I've got Dirty Deeds Thunder Cheap.
Keep people-powered radio going with your membership now. Donate at KAXC.org. Thank you for your support.
It's 5:43. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30 this morning, Minnesota Native News, and we'll hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Just after 7 o'clock, a special edition of the Up North Report. Weather for today, partly sunny and highs near 5 with south winds 5 to 10 gusting higher. For tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the single digits below zero, and northwest winds gusting up to 15 miles per hour. And tomorrow, partly sunny and highs again in the single digits with blustery northwest wind. The Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm has a local history presentation this Thursday, 6 o'clock. Learn about socialist women of the Iron Range with Ty Hiltonen. That is free and open to all.
And United Way Bemidji is offering assistance to those affected by last summer's derecho. If you need repairs to your home or need help navigating insurance coverage, you can fill out a form at unitedwaybemidji.org or contact their office. And Bemidji Community Theatre presents Clue January 30th through February 8th. Friday and Saturday shows are at 7 p.m. with Sunday matinees at 2. Advance tickets available at McKenzie Place and Ken K. Thompson Jewelry. And the American Red Cross is in need of blood and platelet donations to help keep supplies steady. You can find a blood drive near you at redcrossblood.org. More news is next.
Comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Easy Cater, a workplace food platform dedicated to making it easy for organizations to order food from a wide variety of restaurants, set up employee meal programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The matchup for Super Bowl 60 is set. The New England Patriots will take on the Seattle Seahawks. Both teams won their respective conference titles yesterday, and now they have a little under 2 weeks to get ready before they hear Bad Bunny in the halftime show. I mean, at the Super Bowl at Santa Clara, California. Martenzi Johnson is with ESPN's Anscape, and he's with us now to tell us about both games. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
I'm good. I'm better than you because you had to stay up and watch both games. I had to go to sleep so I could get up and do this. Okay, but you're here now, so thank you for that. So the Patriots beat the Denver Broncos 10-7 to win the AFC Championship, and then the Seattle edged out the LA Rams to clinch the NFC title 31-27. Two very different games. What'd you take away from them?
Well, the first one, let's just say that that was playoff football weather. Right. It was blizzard out, all the weather that we're seeing impacting the rest of the country. You saw it on full display there. So it was a low scoring game, but the Broncos couldn't eke it out in the end. They threw an interception. It was a good game to watch, maybe not a good game to play in. On the other side, the Seahawks, that was, if you want to talk about playoff football, Michelle, that was playoff football. Came down to the end. The Seahawks needed a 3rd and 8. And they got exactly 8 by inches. So staying up late last night, that was no problem for me. I enjoyed it. For the first time ever, I enjoy staying up there.
Okay.
That late, I mean.
All right. Well, glad to hear. So the Patriots' first Super Bowl appearance since they had Tom Brady in the lineup. The GOAT for many.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the quarterback matchup for this year's big game.
Yeah. Drake May is a second-year player for the Patriots. He looked all right last year. And only won 14 games with the Patriots last season. And then out of nowhere, he's a MVP candidate this year, 4,000 yards passing, 35 touchdowns. But I think the more impressive story here is Sam Darnold. He's a former number 3 overall pick, cast off by 3 other teams, including his team from last year, the Minnesota Vikings, who he won 14 games with. And that team didn't even make the playoffs this year. Sam Darnold is just one of those incredible comeback stories for the NFL, that those stories that they like to sell really well. And it's really impressive what he was able to pull off. 350 yards last night, 3 touchdowns. And again, that 3rd and 8 that they needed, he got it to Cooper Kupp with just inches to spare.
Hmm. So, and both coaches, their first time leading a team into the Super Bowl.
I think Mac McDonald, again, an amazing story. Was a graduate assistant at Georgia, longtime assistant for the Ravens. Their defensive coordinator helps them get deep in the playoffs a couple years ago, turns around the Seahawks. But Mike Vrabel, I think what's most important about him is that the Tennessee Titans, of all franchises, didn't want him anymore, pushed him out. And then in his first year with the Patriots, he takes them to the Super Bowl. Meanwhile, the Titans haven't made the playoffs in 4 years.
Theme here. Theme emerging. If you want to win a Super Bowl, get kicked to the curb by somebody else. Come back and make the thing happen. Okay, so what are you looking forward to on February 8th, other than Bad Bunny, which all are?
It's number 1 defense versus top 5 offense. On both sides. This is 2 top 5 offenses and defense going against each other. But the Seahawks, I think, have the advantage here. They have Jackson Smith and Jigba, who led the league in receiving. Last night, he had 155 yards. Somehow, he's just always open. I've seen way too many mistakes from the Patriots.
Okay.
Six fumbles by Drake May in the first two rounds.
Okay.
He's just green. Very green.
All right, looking forward to it. Martenzie Johnson with ESPN's Anscape. And this is NPR News.
This is People Powered KAXC, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXC.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast.
Businesses caught in the immigration crackdown.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity. A dedicated advisor can help create a comprehensive wealth plan. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by Revenued, providing working capital for businesses' cash flow needs. Approvals based on revenue, not credit, and funds available in a day at GetRevenued.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Following deadly shootings by immigration agents in Minnesota, more than 60 CEOs there have now signed and sent a letter calling for federal, state, and local officials to de-escalate. Now, this is a turnabout. Last week here, we had discussed so many Minnesota business leaders staying quiet amid the situation. Among the CEOs who put their names on this new letter, William Brown of 3M, Corey Berry of Best Buy, General Mills' Jeff Harmening, and Target's incoming chief executive, Michael Fidelke. Advocates for stricter border enforcement argue the policies over time could mean better jobs for legal workers. But in Minnesota, some businesses have closed or reduced hours, with employees and customers concerned about getting caught up in raids and protests. Kirsty Marone is a correspondent with Minnesota Public Radio, same company as us. She's been reporting from St. Cloud, population 70,000, a city that includes a large Somali American population. Hi, Kirsty.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
You've been going into businesses facing immigration searches and detentions. What are you hearing?
The owners I spoke to say they're struggling with two problems. First, businesses that cater to immigrants are seeing fewer customers. People are scared to leave their homes and venture out for fear of being stopped and detained by ICE. I stopped in at New York Gyro, a popular restaurant in St. Cloud. Usually at lunchtime, it's full of hungry customers craving its halal pita sandwiches and kebabs. But last week,
as you can see, very slow, very, very slow, especially for the last couple of weeks.
That's co-owner Haseeb Azam. He told me that the recent ICE activity in St. Cloud is scaring people away.
We have a lot of mixed customers, like Mexican, Somali, and white. But right now, most of them, the white customer, they come, but not Somali, no Mexican, nothing.
And the other issue for businesses is that some employees are afraid to come to work, even if they are in the U.S. legally. Azam says he and his co-owners are working 12 to 13-hour days just to keep the restaurant going.
13-hour days? Is that sustainable? I mean, not every business could pull those hours off longer term.
That's right. In fact, some have already temporarily closed their doors or reduced hours due to staffing shortages or out of concern for their employees. Restaurants are doing more takeout and delivery orders as fewer customers want to linger for long periods in public places. I visited Star City Mall in St. Cloud. It's a strip mall with several Somali-owned businesses. There's a clinic, a pharmacy, grocery store, several cafes. Dozens of ICE agents clashed with protesters in the mall's parking lot last week. And a few days later, it was noticeably quieter than usual. I met Abde Desani there. He's a Somali-American business owner and also a Democratic candidate for the Minnesota legislature.
I was talking to some of the business people here, and they already see the impact. They see less people showing up to just hang out there, maybe more pickup than sitting down and enjoying their meal or even just socializing with people.
And we're also seeing some businesses adapting the way they operate. So at one restaurant in Minneapolis, the blinds are now drawn and the front door is locked. And a volunteer sits inside to open it for customers.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter Kirsty Marone in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, David.
Gold's hit a record high, over $5,100 an ounce now, up 2% today. This means some investors are nervous. Marketplace's Nova Safo has that.
Prices for precious metals, especially gold, are up because demand is up. Last year, gold prices rose 64%, the most since 1979. Central banks are buying gold, as are traders looking to diversify away from the U.S. dollar, which has weakened against other currencies. Part of this has to do with the Federal Reserve's interest rate cuts. It also has to do with the higher tariffs imposed by the Trump administration and global uncertainty around trade policies. The VIX Volatility Index, Wall Street's fear gauge, is up 17% just this month. It peaked last week as President Trump was ratcheting up threats over a new trade war with European countries over his desire to acquire Greenland. He backed off those threats, and the VIX fell. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
S&P and NASDAQ futures are down between 2 and 3/10% now. This week, the guardians of interest rates at the Fed meet, and we get a pile of quarterly profit reports this week. Apple, Facebook, Meta, and Microsoft among them.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by GEP. With GEP Key Agentic AI and GEP Smart Software, GEP is at the forefront in agentic procurement orchestration and autonomous supply chains.
After a weekend where the weather forced many to skate and to slide, let's turn to the business of the Winter Olympics, which begin February the 6th in northern Italy. Here's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams.
NBC Universal, which has the rights to air the Olympic and Paralympic Games in the U.S., says it sold out all its advertising slots by early January, setting what the company calls a new ad sales record. Beth Mihalik teaches corporate communications at Penn State Lehigh Valley.
Audiences are really drawn to the allure, to the pageantry, to the stories of triumph and tragedy of the Olympic Games, and brands recognize that.
But in terms of economic impact for Olympic host cities, it can be hit or miss. Michael Clark directs the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Kentucky.
When researchers have looked at this, they generally tend to see that the cost associated with hosting the Olympics tends to be considerably higher than the benefits that the cities receive.
Early estimates say the Milan Cortina Games will yield more than $6 billion in economic impact. Kiki Kaplanidou runs the Department of Sports Management at the University of Florida.
They are expecting to make a little bit more money than they spend, but not much more compared to if you look at all the expenditure and what goes into building facilities and all that stuff.
The Winter Olympics will run from February 6th to the 22nd, and the Paralympic Winter Games are starting up March 6th. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Curling. That's what I'm going to be watching. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. You can check out local news stories and conversations. Plus, you can click that donate button to become a member of KAXE. Thanks for your support. Our weather for today, partly sunny, highs near 5 above, winds from the south up to 20 miles per hour, mostly cloudy overnight, lows in the single digits below zero, and northwest wind. For tomorrow, partly sunny with highs again in the single digits, blustery northwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Coming up 1 hour from now, it's a special edition of the Up North Report, and at 7:20, we'll take a look at area events on events.